This is just mental. Like trying to navigate these markets feels like 2008, 2010 all over again. It just feels like there's something freaking off here. They don't trust the government to not come in with a tsunami of long-dated paper at some point because they have to. The debt spiral, we're in it mathematically. There's just nothing we can do here. There's four doors and three of them have been locked and there's just no other option but the fourth door. There's really no choice for these guys. They're going to have to print money at this point. What we are experiencing right now is an information or a knowledge arbitrage. And so people just do not yet understand how Bitcoin is different. Bitcoin is going to trade above $1 million in early 2030s. 2032, 2033, I would be very surprised if we're not touching $1 million Bitcoin. What a freaking beating it's been, huh?
Holy shit. So it's so funny. We were, when I asked you around Christmas time if you want to do a pod, you're like, there's not much happening right now. Maybe we should like hold off for a little bit. How quickly that has changed.
Wow.
I don't know if this is like total recency bias, which it probably is, but this is like the most turbulent macro world I've remember in such a long time.
No, I was just saying this morning on Macro Monday, I was like, this is just mental. Like trying to navigate these markets feels like 2008, 2010 all over again. It just feels like there's something freaking off here. So I'm bringing up this. So I've got AB. Okay, good. Yeah, I mean, it just feels like, I don't know, I just can't put my finger on it. Like, the reality is, Bitcoin's acting like it's, I don't know, it's disconnected from the market. The market's going up. Bitcoin's down 30% from the high, and now it's just, it's like chomping sideways, just grinding. It's like, and lower on the weekend. I don't know. How are people's spirits about it?
Oh, I mean, I think sentiment is shot. Like, it's almost as bad as I ever remember it being. But the weirdest thing is that, like, when gold's been ripping over the last year, Bitcoin's been, like, it's done its thing a little bit, but it's been relatively flat-ish. Not really had the volatility to the upside like gold. But then as soon as gold started crashing, initially it didn't seem like anything was going to happen with Bitcoin. Like it's kind of held firm, but then it's had all the volatility to the downside too. And I don't know what's going on. Like, what's your read on that?
I mean, I want to say that Bitcoin's sniffing out that the markets are just about to get really hairy. And we saw a taste of it on Friday, right? So you saw... You know, he had Warsh be, he was announced on Friday. Well, you kind of felt some turbulence before that because you had Powell come out and, you know, for the first time I hadn't watched him talk for the first time in a while because I just figured he'd be saying the same exact thing. And he came out a little bit more hawkish than even I expected, you know. But let's be clear, this is now... It's not even political. It's personal for him. You know, he was so humiliated by Trump when Trump brought him into that facility the new Fed facility that their new Fed building there or renovating, right? The $1 billion renovation. He brought him in there. They put hard hats on. And Trump's a big guy. And you've got little Powell in his tie and his big hat on. And he just looked, he knew that he knows what he's doing. He made him look like a little caricature, like a little boy, patting him on the head.
Is this when he had the paper, like he had the budget in his hand as well?
Yeah. Completely humiliating. What do you think Powell's thinking? The most powerful attorney, basically, in all of finance, right? Being the head of the Fed. Not really an attorney role, but the, you know, but he's humiliated. Now he's like, fuck you, Trump. You're not going to push me around. And so his legacy is he wants to be known as the guy who engineered a soft landing. I mean, look, the reality is, you know, people don't remember, they won't remember all the things they did before, and they're going to remember these moments, right? Now, you and I will remember that he printed over $5 trillion in 20,
2020 to 2022. And that's what caused all this. That's what caused this inflation. And he's been reeling ever since, scrambling, trying to, you know, tamp it down. He went from this is just transitory to, you know, well, now it's because of possibly because of tariffs to, oh, we have it under control. And that's what he wants. He's done in just a couple months here. His term's over. And so he wants to be remembered as the guy who engineered the soft landing. He wasn't pushed around. He was apolitical. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't in, you know, cahoots with the Treasury, with Bessent or with Trump. And he was independent and he ran the Fed independently. We both know that's ridiculous. You know, they cut rates twice before the election, yeah, before Trump was elected, before the presidential election here, and then they just stopped, and that was like it doesn't really pass the sniff test.
Independent of the Republican Party, but not of the Democrat Party.
Yeah, it just didn't pass the sniff test. So that's what's going on, right? And it comes out Wednesday to bring it back full circle. What we're talking about here, he comes out Wednesday super hawkish and the markets start getting nervous. Well, now you see, then you get Warsh as the nominee that Trump is nominated to replace him. He's got to go through the process here still in front of Congress, but he's got to be confirmed. But the market immediately responded. Now, I feel like what happened was there. You've been seeing the. And we can't talk about macro without talking about metals. Now, you can't talk about it without talking about the debasement trade and that thesis that's come on very strong this year. And gold and silver in particular have taken the mantle on they're gonna be the assets that are going to be the ones that people turn to, investors turn to for protection against ultimate debasement. JP Morgan put out a report. I talked about it. I did a report with Unchained. We'll put a link in here that people can grab it. That talks all about this, the gold and silver debasement, and Bitcoin eventually will be the one that people will turn to. Obviously not today, but that's the thesis. And so on Friday, what I think would happen was when Warsh was announced as the nominee, then that kind of set off a cascading effect with metals. So gold and silver started falling pretty dramatically. Well, here's the thing. Before that, you had the exchanges out there ratcheting up margin requirements for the metals. And that has been that's created an issue for people who own these things, that they have to have larger and larger margin. Well, when you had this announcement on Friday and you started that tumble, it just set off like this cascading effect where it just triggered margin calls one after another after another. And you saw silver do this insane move, you know, from when you look at it from Friday and just looking at the daily to go from $121 per ounce all the way down to 70 and change, like 72 or 73. I mean, mental for an asset like this. These things, that and gold, were moving the entire market cap of Bitcoin multiples over. And it was just insane.
What if you could lower your tax bill and stack Bitcoin at the same time? Well, by mining Bitcoin with Blockware, you can. New tax guidelines from the Big Beautiful Bill allow American miners to write off 100% of the cost of their mining hardware in a single tax year. That's right, 100% write-off. So if you have $100,000 in capital gains or income, you can purchase $100,000 of miners and offset it entirely. Blockware's mining as a service enables you to start mining Bitcoin right now without lifting a finger. Blockware handles everything from securing the miners to sourcing low-cost power to configuring the pool. They do it all. You get to stack Bitcoin at a discount every single day while also saving big come tax season. Get started today by going to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD. Of course, none of this is tax advice. Speak to your accountant or tax advisor to understand how these rules apply to you. And then head over to mining.blockwaresolutions.com/WBD and you'll get 1 week of free hosting and electricity with each hosted miner purchased. Do you wish you could access cash without selling your Bitcoin? Well, Ledger makes that possible. They're the global leader in Bitcoin-backed lending, and since 2018, they've issued over $9 billion in loans with a perfect record of protecting client assets. With Ledger, you get full custody loans with no credit checks or monthly repayments, just easy access to dollars without selling a single sat. As of July 1st, Ledger is Bitcoin only, meaning they exclusively offer Bitcoin-backed loans with all collateral held by Ledger directly or their funding partners. Your Bitcoin is never lent out to generate interest. I recently took out a loan with Ledger. The whole process was super easy. The application took me less than 15 minutes, and in a few hours, I had the dollars in my account. It was really smooth. So if you need cash, but you don't want to sell Bitcoin, head over to ledger.io/WBD, and you'll get 0.25% off your first loan. That's ledger.io/WBD. Privacy was never a priority for mobile networks. For companies like AT&T, T-Mobile, and Verizon, data collection and monetization is the default. But Cape is changing that. Cape is a premium US mobile carrier with nationwide coverage designed from the ground up with privacy and security at the core. When you sign up, Cape collects the absolute minimum data required, stores it for the shortest time possible, and never sells it. They also make you significantly harder to track at the network level and protect against SIM swap attacks, which are becoming one of the biggest security risks out there, especially for Bitcoiners. Cape's SIM swap protection is fundamentally different. Instead of usernames and passwords, your account is secured by a 24-word passphrase similar to how a Bitcoin wallet works. No one can initiate a SIM swap or take control of your phone number except you. This isn't a burner phone or a workaround, it's a normal mobile service built properly. If you care about privacy and security, there is no better mobile carrier. To learn more and get 33% off your first 6 months, head to cape.co/WBD and use code WBD at checkout. That's cape.co/WBD. With fiat money constantly debasing, wealth preservation isn't optional. That's why I recommend Swan Bitcoin, a team of dedicated Bitcoiners who work with families and businesses to build and secure generational wealth with Bitcoin. Strong relationships with clients are at the center of everything Swan does. A dedicated Swan Private Wealth representative, which is a real person that you can text and call, will help you build a Bitcoin wealth strategy using Swan's comprehensive platform of Bitcoin services, including tax advantage retirement accounts, advanced Bitcoin cold storage using collaborative self-custody, inheritance planning with both trust and entity accounts, tax loss harvesting, asset-backed loans, and more. Swan have helped over 100,000 clients since 2020, and if you're serious about acquiring and securing Bitcoin, I recommend Swan. Meet the team at swan.com/WBD, which is swan.com/WBD. I'm pretty sure on Friday, gold's down move was like 3.5 times the Bitcoin market cap in a single day.
Incredible. Yeah.
Insane.
Incredible. And so, but I think it was not just Warsh. It was also the margin calls, and I wrote all about this in my newsletter this past week. This incident, this specific thing with Warsh, and what it really means for him to be the nominee. Well, yeah, he came out. He's been known as a hawk, meaning that. For your listeners who aren't in the world of Fed and Fed speak, let's translate it for them. When you're a dove, that means that you're expansionary. You want low rates, you want QE, you want easy money, and you want to juice the economy that way. When you're a hawk, you're tight money supply. You're tight on rates, meaning you want to keep them high and make sure that you do not allow inflation to notch or ratchet up. And you're against QE if you're a hawk. And he's vocally been like that before. In fact, he basically wanted to vote against QE and all that way back when, and Bernanke insisted that he get on board to have a unanimous vote. And then he did, and he quit, basically.
So this was at the time of like the financial crisis when he was a governor. Is that right?
He was so young, and I think 38 years old, and I'll have to pull up my news. I usually have my newsletter up. Let's see what, you know, I've got the actual data in here, so I don't want to quote the wrong thing on your show here, Danny. So just give me a...
I'm pretty sure he was the youngest Fed governor ever, I think.
He is super young, you know, 38 years old. That's correct. So he's 38 years old, Fed governor, and he's being muscled by these guys. He's just a kid, and he's being muscled by these guys, and he decides, okay, I'll vote that way, but I don't like it, and you're going to lose me. And so then he leaves. But remember, he worked at Morgan Stanley, right, before he was a Fed governor. So they used him to kind of help engineer this whole process and work with Morgan Stanley and convert it to a bank holding company. This is all in the newsletter, so I won't bore your listeners with this. But the bottom line is, he's an insider. He knows how this stuff works. He's been there before, and he's the youngest Fed governor in history. When he was 35, and Bush is the one who put him on the Fed. So, but anyways. Then he goes and he marries Jane Lauder, you know, S.A. Lauder, and the granddaughter of S.A. Lauder. And I mean, her father's worth almost $5 billion. So, I mean, this is just, I mean, how far away from the Cantillon effect are you really? I mean, not very far. Like, this is
right next to the spigot.
You're right next to the spigot. And so, I mean, you know, yes, he's been a very vocal hawk. He's also benefited greatly personally from this whole system, clearly, whether it's through marriage into such a wealthy family or through Morgan Stanley and all the rest of it, he has. I don't know the guy. I don't have anything against him. Just on observation, though, the reality is he's stepping into a situation with a, and it kind of gives, in my opinion, it kind of gives Trump cover. It's like, look, I nominated a hawk. If he lowers rates, it's because it's the right thing to do. But we all know what's happening here. We have over $10 trillion of debt that's coming due here this year. Why? Because we never termed out the debt. We've talked about this ad nauseum, but the problem is Scott Bessent wanted, he was so also very vocal and critical of Janet Yellen when during the campaign, when Trump was campaigning, he was very vocal about how she just made a major mistake. She should have termed out the debt. And he said, I'm going to term out the debt. That's what we're going to do. We're going to move it back out on the calendar to manage it better. So we're not playing this game of chicken of $2 trillion plus deficits. We're just tacking on trillion after trillion after trillion dollars on top of the T-bill, on all the T-bills that are out there, and demanding more and more and more banks and individuals to buy these T-bills. Where are you going to find all that demand? Okay, we're going to get to that. But the issue here is that he was super vocal and critical about all that. Why was he? Well, to be fair, Janet Yellen she screwed up royally too. We have so many problems here. And if you go back in sequence, you have Janet was the Fed. She was the head of the Fed at one point. She was chair of the Fed. So she knows how this works. Then she goes to the Treasury. Then you've got Powell, the head of the Fed. You've got the lockdowns. You've got supply chain issues. You got all that going on. And then he goes and prints $5 trillion plus dollars. Okay, that was stupid. We got that going on. That's number one. Now you've got, oh God, we need people to be buying these treasuries because we've printed so much money. We bought all these. How are we going to get them off our sheets? At the same time, you have Russia that goes and invades Ukraine, and you and I have talked about this before. I may have said this on your show before, but in a monumentally stupid decision, they decide to sees their assets, Russia's assets, United States decides to seize their assets, seize their treasuries, kick them off the SWIFT network. I mean, how stupid was that? So now you're in a situation, flash forward. Now you've got inflation raging, the Fed's having to raise rates. Yellen knew this was going to happen. She had to. I mean, she had to know, and she didn't. She missed her opportunity. She didn't term out the debt. They were issuing T-bills. She never changed the quarterly funding, to deal with this better before the rates had to be ratcheted up. And so here we are. Now you've got $10 trillion of debt that's got to be turned over annually. Plus, you're adding $1 to $2 trillion of that every single year, probably more. And you need more buyers of treasuries. Where are they going to come from? Well, now you've got this whole fight in Congress about basically the stablecoin legislation that they're trying to make it. They're trying to create a situation where you have stable coins that are pegged to the US dollar, clearly, issued through banks. And the banks are the ones who are going to be buying these treasuries because they're using them for stable coins. Now the banks are in the fight over whether or not they have to pay interest to their customers who own these stable coins. I mean, it's just insidious, right? So they buy these stable coins. They get that yield on the stable coins and they don't pass it on to the customers. It's basically what they're doing now. They got this cash sitting on the Fed balance sheet. They're getting paid interest on this and they're not passing along to their customers. The customers get 0.002% interest rate or 0.2% interest rate instead of the 4 point, whatever it should be. At this point, you know, back then it was 4 point. At this point, it should be at least 3.7%. They're giving them nothing. They want the same deal. They want to keep that, you know, that profit engine going. And so, but anyways, to land the plane on this, now we've got an issue where Bessent is at the Treasury. The rates are still high because the Fed refuses to lower them. You know, Fed funds is still at on average 3.65%, you know, because it's 3.5 to 3.75%. And so it's 3.6% or so. And the 10 years out at 4.3%. And everything is keyed off the 10-year, Danny. You know this. Mortgage rates, auto loan rates, personal lines of credit, your credit card rates, everything is keyed off the 10-year. And if it's at 4.3%, well, where do you think mortgages are? They're over 6%. It's keyed off of that. And that's what Trump wants to lower. But here's the thing that people keep hearing them say over and over and over again. I cannot emphasize this enough, is that Bessent will be out there saying, we've got to lower rates. Trump will be out there saying, we got to lower rates. The Treasury will go lower rates. And what will happen? Well, when they lowered rates right before the election, they lowered them by 50 basis points. And the 10-year rose by 50 basis points. Why? Because people don't believe that either inflation is tackled or that they're going to be able to issue enough, have enough buyers of treasuries, 10-year treasuries, that they're going to be able to issue them at that rate. So what they're saying is they don't trust the government to not come in with a tsunami of long-dated paper at some point because they have to. Because the deficits are so high, the Lynn Alden, nothing stops this train. My take on this has been the debt spiral. We're in it mathematically. There's just nothing we can do here. There's four doors, and this is how I like to frame it now, is there's four doors and three of them have been locked and there's just no other option but the fourth door. You know, the austerity door locked. You're not going to get austerity. Neither party is going to cut expenses enough at the government level that it's going to make a difference. We tried with DOGE. We're still at $2 trillion deficits. Okay. Taxing, raising taxes. First of all, it's not popular. Second of all, it's only popular with the people who want taxes on billionaires. And you see what's happening in California and New York. The billionaires are leaving. They're literally going to Miami and Austin. They're leaving. They're coming here. Danny, the housing prices here are going up because we have a deluge of wealthy people coming in from California into Las Vegas, for people who don't know where I'm sitting. It's crazy. And the houses, just the nice houses go fast here. But anyways, so taxes don't really work, number one, because they're not that popular. And number two, there's a productivity, it crests at a certain point of taxes where the amount that you'll bring in taxes on GDP levels out and peaks because it starts hurting productivity. Why is that? Because companies who are taxed higher, small companies who are taxed higher, individuals, they aren't reinvesting in productive lines of products, in new products. You know, they're out hiring people, they're paying taxes, and it goes to the government and it gets wasted. We've seen how much waste is in there. I mean, Minnesota is, if the people who are not on Twitter and X and don't know what's going on in Minnesota, God help you, the fraud in that state is, it's crazy. The fraud in California is insane. They just waste money. It goes right into their pockets. It's the Cantillon effect at the political level. It's awful. And so, and it's both parties, by the way. It's not just one party. So that's the second door. The third door, well, we could default. You could just default on your debt and reset it. That's not happening. You would never do that with debt that's denominated in your own currency. You'll just print more money, which is door four. And we keep doing it. We're doing it every day. Right now, we're doing it in soft QE, where they're out there, they're buying T-bills in order to make sure that the bank reserves are high enough that it can meet the velocity of capital needed for this amount of GDP, which is about 10%. We're getting to that level. It's starting to make the Fed a little bit nervous. So they're out there buying T-bills now. Regular market processes, right? No. It's QE light. And eventually, what the market is telling you is they're going to have to buy longer dated treasuries. They're going to have to do Operation Twist, where they're out there buying longer dated treasuries, and that's full on QE. Not yet, but they will. Maybe it takes an event. Maybe it just takes a certain amount of yield on the 10-year. They have no choice. They've got to get in there and start controlling it through yield curve control effectively by buying bonds and getting those rates lower. So anyway, that's a long way of saying that, yeah, Warsh is he's known as a hawk. That's great.
But
he has no choice.
There's so much in there. I want to definitely get into the four doors. But on Warsh, he was very young Fed governor. He must be an impressive person. I don't know very much about him, but he clearly had a very successful career.
Yeah.
He's against QE, which I think we both agree makes even though it's great for our Bitcoin bags, it's not great for society. I agree with him there.
It's terrible. Yeah.
But there's no way Trump is going to nominate someone who is not going to lower rates and potentially do something like QE and try and stimulate the economy, get things going. So what changed between him leaving as Fed governor to now that's allowed him to get this nomination?
Well, I mean, you know, he remember that he's a kind of a product of Stanley Druckenmiller, right?
Okay.
And so is Scott Bessent. So they all know each other. I mean, Danny's a big club. We're not in it. You know? I mean, I didn't make $120,000 a year and become worth $240 million in Congress. You know, it's crazy. So okay, that's a big accusation. My feeling on it is not really what his stance is going to be as much as what are the choices? What are the choices? And it's just math. And they're going to fall back on that. They're going to say, we're doing what we need to do to shore up the markets, to make sure that we don't have dysfunction in the credit markets at some point. I don't know when that happens. I'm not calling for a credit event or a failed auction. I'm just saying that look at Japan. Look at how long they had to be out there controlling yields. And now look at it. It's blowing out because they've lost control. So, what changed is he's an insider. He knows these guys. They feel comfortable with him. Whatever he said to Trump, whatever he said to Scott Bessent, it made them feel comfortable that he's on board with doing what they need to do. Then they know that they're going to need to manage this at some level. Now, I don't know how much it's going to be. Now, here's where it gets crazy. There's been a lot of people calling for a productivity miracle, and that you're going to now have this spike in productivity because of AI. Well, remember, you're too young to remember this, but when I started on Wall Street, we didn't have these things, man. I had a BlackBerry. It was like a little dial BlackBerry. It was like a beeper with text messages. And so we all thought that's going to make us all so productive. It's going to be, you know, wow, the productivity is going to be through the roof. Well, yeah, it did help productivity, but also just dumped more work on you. It just became that each individual was expected to be able to do more. Why? Because they could answer emails 24/7. They could answer messages or phone calls or whatever they need to do. Sign documents, for God's sakes, at dinner on your phone. And that's gotten to be where it is. Okay. Well, why does this matter? It matters because if you have this productivity boom, well, on the other side of it with AI, there is a casualty on this one. And the casualty is that young or entry-level data entry kind of clerk, simple math analysis, simple analyst, the number of jobs that are going to be taken over, coding. I mean, coding's dead. To be a coder, the vibe coding thing is just, that's mind-blowing. You don't need to have somebody who understands code anymore. This stuff does it better and without mistakes. And so the thing is, it's going to cost people jobs. And as Jeff Booth says, and this is this whole thesis, this is what got me to understand and be and really dive deep into the Bitcoin rabbit hole and get comfort around it, is that this technological revolution is deflationary. At the same time, now it's going to be really hard on some jobs. You and I are on Twitter and we see this stuff and we see what's happening in the AI world. Danny, the normal person is not seeing this stuff. I talk to people who are not in the know, who are just not on this stuff. We're just going to work every day. They're nurses or doctors or lawyers, and they're not looking at this stuff. They have no idea what's going on. Claudebot, no clue. that's so far down the road. They don't even know what Gemini versus OpenAI versus Grok versus Anthropic and Claude. They don't know the differences, the different engines, the different capabilities. They have no clue. They just hear AI and say, oh yeah, ChatGPT, you plug it in and get, it's kind of like Google.
Yeah.
They have no clue what's coming. So the point is, this whole thesis for Jeff Booth is that the acceleration of advancement in technology brings the acceleration of this deflationary effect. And so what's it going to do to GDP?
If you haven't tried out Club Orange yet, then now is the time. It's my go-to place to find Bitcoiners whenever I'm traveling. Club Orange is a social app built for Bitcoiners where you can find local meetups and events in your area and find merchants that are accepting Bitcoin. There are over 19,000 Bitcoiners on there, and whether you're at home or traveling, it's a great place to keep in touch with Bitcoiners from all over the world. I've been using Club Orange since it was Orange Pill app, and it really is awesome. So if you're on there, drop me a DM and say hi. And if you want to find out more and download the app, just search for Club Orange on your app store or go to cluborange.org. This episode is brought to you by Anchor Watch. The thing that keeps me up at night is the idea of a critical error with my Bitcoin cold storage. And this is where Anchor Watch comes in. With Anchor Watch, your Bitcoin is insured with your own A+ rated Lloyd's of London insurance policy, and all Bitcoin is held in their time-locked multi-sig vaults. So you have the peace of mind knowing your Bitcoin is insured while not giving up custody. So whether you're worried about inheritance planning, rent tax, natural disasters, or just your own silly mistakes, you're protected by Anchor Watch. Rates for fully insured custody start as low as 0.55% and are available for individual and commercial customers located in the US. Speak to AnchorWatch for a quote, and for more details about your security options and coverage, visit anchorwatch.com today. That is anchorwatch.com. But could you not have a scenario where GDP actually increases quite significantly because of like productivity gains with AI and stuff, even while employment is also dropping off a cliff? Like, I could see a world where we have massive productivity gains, but also huge rise in unemployment.
Exactly. And so you have a huge rise in unemployment, which will hurt GDP. It just, everything you're seeing is you're getting to do more and more and more for less, for fewer dollars. That's deflationary. Well, the productivity gain will be because everybody's using these things and plugging them in and getting productivity out of it. But how much is that going? What are the gains in dollar terms? So we're going to need the offsetting effect, which is expansion of the money supply. And so that's the scary part.
Yeah. I mean, something I've said a load of times on the show at this point is I can't see a world where we don't have some form of universal basic income at this point. Like, if AI does what people are predicting that it will, and replace a large number of jobs, like you were saying with software developers, like one good developer now can probably replace 10 with like using AI tools alongside themselves. So like,
there's your productivity gain. So the company makes more money because that one person could do 10 jobs.
Exactly. Right? And so that's where I'm like, yeah, I think you could get increased productivity with increased unemployment, but then does UBI have to follow that? Because what are people going to do if they can't find jobs? Like the government isn't just going to let them sit and rot.
Yeah. That's a philosophical question that's beyond my pay grade, you know. I do expect something like that. If you talk to Elon, that's what he believes. He believes you're going to have, and he's going to be like a wealthy universal income. It's not just basic.
Yeah, that's one that I can't understand, though. I don't understand how that can actually make sense, like how the math from that can make sense.
Well, I think we have a long way to go and a lot of disruption, a lot of pain to get there, to be truthful. And that's not a cynical view. It's just it's a cautious view. Mm. So any way you cut it though, Danny, that's the whole point of all of this, is that there's really no choice for these guys. They're going to have to print money at this point.
So with Walsh coming in, potentially. So actually, maybe we should explain that. So he's been nominated by Trump, but what actually happens next before he is the Fed chair?
Yeah, so now he's got to go through a Senate confirmation process. And I don't know what that schedule is, but that's what the normal route is. God only knows that the Senate could come up with something. Who knows? I think he chose him because he doesn't appear like he's just going to be this figurehead that is going to do Trump's bidding and just lower rates. It doesn't appear like that. And the market's telling you that they believe that, you know, he's not going to. So as far as the gold and silver markets, that's what they were saying. Yeah, the long end of the curve is still hanging in there. So that's the question. It's like, it's kind of a battle between realities here. And my take is, like I said, is like, he's not going to have a choice. There's eventually, we're going to have to lower rates. We're going to have to do QE. It's just math. I mean, it's not something that's trying to pump Bitcoin bags. It's just math. It's just the reality of the situation.
So I was reading your newsletter, and that was one of the interesting things, because basically all you saw on Twitter that day is that gold and silver reacted, seemed like people thought he was going to be a hawk, which I find hard to understand because, like, if Trump's nominating him, I imagine they've had plenty of conversations and he's going to, I think he probably will do Trump's bidding. But you brought this chart up on the newsletter. Can you explain what this actually is?
Yeah. So this is the different yields, right? And so you can see in here the, it's the 2 year, the 10 year, and the 30 year yields. And so, you know, they gyrated pretty heavily here, right? So, and that's the surprising part is that investors are trying to get a handle on actually what is going to happen here. Like where are we going here with these rates? And they settled in just a little bit lower than they started out, but it's not that much. It's just the gyration was what was interesting. Like, look at this. Like, these are U.S. treasuries, and look at where they're going. Like, it's just like it's crazy for them to just run around like up and down like that in one day. It's just not typical, and you're seeing that with all these things.
So this is the market trying to figure out what he's going to do. And where has it kind of settled? Has the bond market decided it's going to be pretty neutral, his appointment?
Well, that's the other chart, is if you bring up Fed funds, the Fed funds charts, you can see that the Fed funds futures, which are those two Bloomberg charts in there, the Fed funds futures, they didn't move around pretty much at all. And that was surprising. So if you think this guy's going to be a hawk or this guy's going to be a dove because of being nominated by Trump, then you would have expected the Fed funds futures to move, meaning the Fed funds futures will trade according to where investors believe Fed funds will settle out. So
that's these two.
Exactly. So before he was announced, this is like the day of the Fed meeting on Wednesday. So it's still showing the 128 meeting number there.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you could see here on the left, the implied overnight rate looks like it bottoms out there at about somewhere about 3.1%. That's where it bottoms out there in the end of 26, beginning of 27. So 3.1%. So that says that the implied number of rates of hikes or cuts on the right hand side, you can see that it's somewhere around, you know, somewhere around 2.2 cuts. Now you go to the next chart after he was announced, and what do you have? The number of cuts went down a little bit.
Yeah. So on the previous one, it's more like 1.75, and then after he was announced, it goes down to about 2.2.
And now it's exactly. So it's barely, and then it's right at 3.1% is where you're coming in on the total, the ultimate rate. So it's like it was a non-event to the Fed funds futures. So the Fed funds traders are like, well, he's just going to keep doing what Powell's doing is what they're considering right now. And so what you're watching is real time, all these markets just trying to figure out what the heck is going to happen. And what's interesting about it is that the gold and silver, as far as if they were really being bought up because of worries about U.S. debasement, this is not just U.S. investors, remind you. Like, this is the most of this is coming from central banks. I mean, they're buying 1,000 tons from the last 3 years, which is just, that's double what the normal high rate is. And so they're concerned about holding U.S. dollars, meaning they're concerned about holding U.S. treasuries, meaning that they're concerned about holding U.S. dollars because of that debasement. So for gold to sell off so steeply, that was a little bit of a wake-up call. And does that mean that, oh, hey, we actually are going to get this under control? I don't think so.
So with the gold, like the gold trade has been insane over the last 18 months or so. Do you think this is that trade sort of ending, or do you think it's just taking a break?
Well, I don't think it's ending. I just think it's just taking a break for sure. You know, you can't have something go. Look, the old saying is trees don't go, they don't grow to the, straight to the sky. And so it was due some sort of pullback. I did not expect it to be so violent so fast. It was due a pullback, though. Do I think it's over? No, not by any stretch. What I would hope and expect, though, is that as gold and silver kind of settle in and the volatility decreases and they get into a trading range, that's where anybody who's been playing them for momentum, obviously there were some players that were playing momentum in them. Once that happens, then they get bored, and hopefully that's when they rotate back into Bitcoin.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Like, when does Bitcoin get its run?
Yeah. So, well, I'm wary of Bitcoin here. And the reason is because we haven't had a sell-off in the general market. It's like Bitcoin, if you looked at Bitcoin the last number of times we had a big sell-off in the general market, then Bitcoin kind of front ran it. And then everything kind of followed. And so I expected, oh, Bitcoin's sniffing out the Mag 7 being overvalued here and the general market's going to sell off. It never did. So Bitcoin sold off. But then gold and silver ripped higher. So there was a negative cascading effect there where Bitcoin kept selling off and kept grinding lower because Bitcoin and gold kept grinding higher. So it was like people were rotating out. Anybody who was looking for momentum was rotating out of Bitcoin into gold and silver. Not anybody, but some people who were. And so here's my concern is that we get some sort of steep market drawdown because of an event, Danny, that causes that typical everything correlates to one trade where you walk into the hedge fund office, you walk into an investment fund, you say, just sell 10 or 20% of everything. I don't care, get it off the books. I need liquidity. Why would you do that? Because you need to be ready for margin calls. Even if you're a hedge fund, you're on portfolio margining, meaning that you're getting haircuts that are as low as maybe 2, 3, 4%. And with certainly 5 or 6% with your blue chip stocks, meaning that you only have to put up 5 or 6% and you could borrow 96% against it. Well, they move those requirements kind of dynamically during periods of stress. So if you expect there's going to be a period of stress, you're selling stuff over the weekend. Well, what can you sell? Bitcoin. So Bitcoin goes down over the weekend. Everything correlates to one, meaning gold and silver go down along with stocks. That worries me because if that happens, Bitcoin's still not safe here at 78. It will go into the 60s and test that, you know, possibly test that lower band of the power law in whatever it is, high 50s now. So that's actually a good question, exactly where it is. So, and if you look at it as of today, if you're looking at the power law for 211, it's 52.6, 52.7-ish, somewhere around 50 to 55,000. I would expect that it would test that if we get a steep drawdown in everything, because markets correlate to one. This is something that investment funds and hedge funds will be able to sell. And you sell what you can, not what you want to. So does that mean that there's pain coming? Well, I don't know. But I do believe, Danny, that Bitcoin over the long term is going higher. If things settle out here and this market resumes its march upwards, I would expect that Bitcoin will join in. That's my expectation, that we will go back and test our all-time highs again this next year. But that's a lot of ifs.
I mean, 58K gang might be right. I mean, that memes are reality. Like, if that happens, it'll be absolutely hilarious. But one of the things that like Trump is pretty cooked, I think, in the midterms. With everything that's happening, like he is, it seems at least from afar, he can't really win the midterms unless something extraordinary happens in the next like 8 months or whatever it is. And one of those things has to be the economy absolutely flying. So he's going to do everything in his power to make that happen, I imagine. Right. Like Bitcoin must do well in that scenario. So is that one of the things that's kind of you're holding out hope for?
Well, I mean, I'm wary of that them juicing the economy, lowering rates, heating it up, because then you're going to have inflation again. Mm-hmm. Inflation doesn't come on right away, though, as we all saw. You print money, you buy bonds, and it filters in through the Cantillon effect, and it kind of filters in that way. And so it takes time. It certainly won't happen before the midterms, even if they started printing today.
Yeah.
It would be difficult for that to happen. So I don't think he's worried about that. He's more worried about, oh, let's keep the economy juicing and we'll manage it. We just won't let it get out of control like Powell did. That's what he's thinking, I bet. And so he's going to play that game. He's going to try to, you know, walk that tightrope. It's a tough one to walk, as we've experienced. But you don't have to come in with a bazooka. You know, you don't have to print $5 trillion, I don't think, unless there's some sort of credit issue or a credit event or black swan, then you're going to have to print more than five. You might have to print 10. So, and that's the scary part. And on the backside of that, of course, Bitcoin will not benefit, but it will reflect the devaluation of the dollar on the other side of it. That's what it will do.
Yeah. I mean, with the political incentives as they are, I think they would deal with inflation after the midterms if they thought juicing the economy would actually win them the midterms. But we will see. It's going to be an interesting year. You obviously follow like the liquidity cycles pretty heavily. Michael Howell is... He's your guy on that. Where are we at in terms of liquidity cycles?
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, is that Michael believes that we're going to top out here this year. And that global, because when you look at it, it's not just M2. You got to look at the global situation. And if you have the ECB tightening, if you got the UK tightening, if Australia starts tightening, they're big markets. But it's not just central banks. It's the full on liquidity, and meaning the borrowing and the volatility. If volatility rises in bonds, well, that means that there's a higher requirement for collateral, which is an input. Obviously central bank buying, central bank QE, central bank QT, those are all things, the interest rates themselves, and then the shadow banking. And so all you need is some disruption in the markets in that general cycle, and you'll get a contraction of the money supply. But he's been saying for a long time that he's thinking that we're going to be topping out here in this next quarter. And so we'll see if he's right. But he's more of, and I like him, Danny, I like his analysis, because I don't know exactly how he calculates it. It's proprietary, but he does liquidity, and that includes all the debt and financing and shadow banking, where the financial firms are lending to each other, and that's repo market stuff and all of that. So that all matters. It's not just printing money. So M2 is useful. It's the biggest component of all that, but it's not the only one.
Yeah, I need to get him on the show. You have to do an introduction for me, because I'd like to get into that.
Yeah, absolutely. I like Michael. I'll intro him to you.
It sounds like you're pretty cautious though going into 2026 on Bitcoin.
This is, well, look, you know, I co-manage the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund with David Foley. And we have to be exposed, because that's what our investor, we're on a Bitcoin standard. We own Bitcoin instead of dollars. That's part of our thesis. That's our operating, measure. And so we're looking for the best opportunities we can find out there. We're finding some opportunities. We're picking away at them. When we see some of these things draw down so steeply, we're picking opportunities. We're not buying every single treasury, Bitcoin treasury company. There's a handful that we think that we feel comfortable with, that we feel can execute on the plan of basically creating Bitcoin through fiat arbitrage, and MicroStrategy is one of them. I can't talk too much about it because I'm on the board of directors of Strive now, but Strive is one of them. Metaplanet, obviously, 21, Jack Mahler's company. Those are ones that we feel have. And not call out any of the other ones, but those are, and then, you know, we own some out in some emerging markets like Orange, down in Brazil. So there are some that we feel are well positioned and we are exposed to. The good news is that as tumultuous as it's been, especially for the Bitcoin treasury companies, is that because we're a hedge fund and we operate in the capital markets, we are able to buy these in the private market and get them at close to or under 1 mNAV to the underlying Bitcoin of the company. So, we have exposure to the Bitcoin, but that we haven't been hurt by the contraction of that multiple of mNAV on the underlying Bitcoin. So that's the good news. But to answer your question, we are cautious, and we have some interesting hedges on to protect against that downside volatility, which we expect there to be volatility here. It's insurance. It costs money. It's difficult to do without either just throwing away money, burning the money, or getting yourself in a situation where you're not really protected. It's a challenge. But we've done this for many years. We've both been doing this for about 30 years. And so we've seen a lot of markets and we've seen a lot of situations, and we've got some interesting hedges on that we feel will help mitigate some of that volatility. So that's a long way of saying that we would not be surprised at all if Bitcoin goes and tests these levels again. But the good news is that when you do things like that, Danny, and this is what, listeners, ought to have in their head, is that when you protect against volatility like that, what happens is you wind up making money on that hedge on the way down. Then you harvest that and you turn around and you plow it back into what you believe in long term. And so you can then, what happens is you're buying convexity. Because you're buying these things on the dip, and you're purchasing securities that will give you convexity on the upside, meaning that it's a form of leverage that doesn't expose you too far on the downside, and so you're already buying them at a very attractive price, and you've made money on the downside, and then you're going to make money on the way back up. That's the way we are, that's our goal in our operating and our mechanism here. And so we're cautious. We're not just plowing everything in every single dip. We're being aware and trying to be nimble without being cute. And it's a pretty fine line to walk.
Yeah. So are you doing this with like options on IBIT and stuff? I had David Dredge on the show recently. I don't know if you know him, but he talks a lot about this. Is that the kind of stuff you're doing? Is it option contracts on IBIT and things like that?
Yeah, we've done options contracts on all kinds of stuff. And it's sometimes we do it on securities that we feel would be proper hedges for a general market downturn, and give us a little bit more beta exposure, which would be more like Bitcoin. Because the problem with IBIT is that the options are expensive. Or that's a challenge. It's not a problem. It's just a challenge that the options are expensive. So you have a choice. You can either just buy insurance on the downside, you just buy puts, or you can do some sort of put spread where you're buying this insurance, but you're also selling the insurance past the level that you're comfortable with taking the risk of. Because I don't think that Bitcoin's going to 20,000. So to be hedged under 50, under 40,000, it doesn't really make sense to me. And so you can harvest some of that on the other side. And what happens is you wind up giving yourself a better risk reward of that insurance. That doesn't come without challenges, though. It's not just like, oh yeah, that's a great idea, we'll do that. Because what winds up happening, Danny, is that as you're still far out on some of these options, you have what's called theta, which is the time value that's embedded in that option. And so even if you get, let's say you're protected down 10% down to down 20%, well, if the market goes down, you know, IBIT goes down 18%, that's great. You've captured 100%, or you've captured 18, you've captured 90 odd percent of what you expected to capture without the cost of the options. And you just cover them, right? Well, you can't, because there's still time value embedded in that short option. And so it's really difficult to stick the landing there. And so you wind up trading around them a little bit to make sure you get the best out of it. You harvest the most that you can out of it. And that's where you have to be nimble and not cute, is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, this stuff's way too complicated for me. Like, I only vaguely understand options. Like, there's no way I'm touching any of this stuff. In fact, yesterday I significantly increased my DCA, and I'm tempted to take out another Bitcoin backed loan. Like, taking out a Bitcoin backed loan when it's 126,000 is obviously higher risk. But like down here, I'm starting to see. Well, I'm very tempted. We'll see. I might do another one. Yeah, but
it's tempting. Like, I always caution people to be aware that you're, you know, when your collateral is of, you know, you're buying something that on margin, and that collateral is that volatile asset that you're buying. It's just, it is dangerous. And so you have to do it with money that you're very comfortable with.
And it's about position sizing, right? Like, if you do it with a small enough part of your stack, then you can always cover the potential margin call. Like, there's ways to do it in a sensible way.
There's ways to do it sensibly, without taking undue risk and without being risk of being wiped out. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, I'm like eternally perma bullish. Like, I really struggle to see a scenario where Bitcoin's not, you know, significantly higher in a year's time, but I'm often wrong. So don't take that with a grain of salt. But James, this has been awesome.
I'm with you. I believe that what we are experiencing right now, Danny, is an information or a knowledge arbitrage.
Yeah.
And so people just do not yet understand how Bitcoin is different and why it is the ultimate store of value and the ultimate debasement asset. They just don't understand it yet. There's a lot of confusion. There, you know, the mainstream media puts out confusing and hit pieces about it all the time. They commingle it with all the other cryptocurrencies, and they just call them all the same thing. And so I have friends who say, "Oh yeah, I own that. I own Bitcoin. I own the Solana one." And it's like, they just don't get it. And it's okay. It's not their fault. They're just not interested in doing the research themselves, and they're listening to mainstream media and getting their news off of Facebook or their research off of Facebook. They're just not getting it. And so there is an information arbitrage that you and I are experiencing right now. It feels bad, and it makes you feel like, am I an idiot? Am I just stupid that I'm, how early am I here? And the answer is, you're still pretty early, because I think that Bitcoin is going to trade above $1 million in early 2030s. 2032, 2033, I would be very surprised if we're not touching $1 million Bitcoin. That's me. That's my thesis. That's where I believe this thing is going. But I also believe that part of that is that arbitrage, that knowledge arbitrage will close. And as that does, you know, you're going to have the Harvards and the Yales and the University of Texas and the CalPERS and the Texas teachers and every pension and fire fund out there taking positions in Bitcoin as a core asset. And when they do that, that's when that knowledge begins to really spread, and people are like, oh, so Bitcoin is different. Okay, so Bitcoin is different. It's not just this moonshot thing. It's digital gold. Okay, then I should probably own some. And funny enough, is I think that that's going to be a much healthier rise for Bitcoin in price and a much more stable rise. It's not going to be this massive volatile thing. It's going to be like, people are, oh, I get it. Okay, I get it. Oh, okay, I understand now. I understand how it's different. And then we'll feel vindicated and, you know, we'll look like we're 143 years old when we're just in our 50s or in your case, 30s.
I mean, I'm looking forward to feeling vindicated again, but I'm with you. I think like I could see $1 million Bitcoin by the mid 2030s and it's really not that far away. So you want to buy it now and sell it to them later.
Exactly. Just hold on tight.
James, this has been awesome, man. I'll see you in Vegas in a couple of months. Maybe we should run it back.
Absolutely.
But thank you for coming on the show. Tell everyone where to go to find the newsletter. I think it's one of my favorite newsletters in Bitcoin, so people should check it out.
Thank you, Danny. It's called The Informationist. It's you can find it at jameslavish.com. It's on Substack. There's a free version that you get one full piece every month, and then there's a paid version you get all four. It comes out every Sunday morning. So I really enjoy writing it, and it's a great community. We get a lot of comments in there and some banter, and it's good. So it's something that I didn't expect to become what it has, you know? When I was talking about this with my wife last night, she's like, "Well, how did you even come up with the idea of it?" And I was just thinking, "Well, do you remember that book? I think it's called How Things Work, and it's this big, like coffee table looking book that's got photos of like elevators or buildings with or very tall buildings and structures or airplanes, and you see a cross section of it." Really cool drawings. You see how everything works in there, but it's really simple. And so and I was thinking my vision for this thing was it would be kind of like that in a newsletter. And now, you know, with the ability to make infographics much more easily with because I understand Photoshop and all that stuff. And with AI, it's a big help. It's becoming more and more like that. So I'm having more fun with it than ever. So there's that. And then of course, if you're an accredited investor and you're interested in owning exposure to Bitcoin and Bitcoin companies in a little different way, we have the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund 2 just launched, and perfect timing actually for people who want to get exposure to this thing. And so if you're interested, just go to bitcoinopportunity.fund. And reach out, and we can jump on a call and see if it's something that would be appropriate for you, and kind of talk through it. So, and that's it.
Awesome. I will make sure there's a link to the newsletter in the show. But thank you, James. I will see you soon, man.
You're welcome, Danny. Always good to see you and talk to you. See you in Vegas soon.